You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community solar-powered, even on these cloudy days, radio, broadcasting from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. It's nice to be back. We had
a little vacation. I was down in Austin visiting my children and grandbabies, and we went to the zoo, and we went for a walk on the ferry trail at the Botanical Gardens.
Oh, gosh.
And what else did we do? Oh, we ate Snow Beach. We always have to go to Snow Beach. It's trailer where they sell snow cones that are so good, really, really good, and no high fructose corn syrup.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I wonder how they do that.
Yeah, and it's Logan's favorite place to go. Logan's the three-year-old.
The three-year-old going on 10.
I know. He's quite amazing.
So watch him do a puzzle, which I bought him
for Christmas.
Yeah, I don't think I could do it. It's a it's a puzzle of a shark, wooden puzzle of a shark, just... You know, there's no tray or anything. It's just the...
Yeah, and it's hard.
It's hard,
It's hard. But he's motivated because sharks are his favorite animal.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Okay. Followed by crocodiles.
And dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs. Tigers. And whales.
Oh,
so,
my.
Yeah, real cuddly things. I guess that's what comes from being raised with a Rottweiler from the
I guess.
From the moment of your birth.
I guess so.
Anyway, we have a really exciting show today. I'm really glad to be back in the studio with one of the very first guests that we ever had on Writers' Voices and one of my dearest friends from years ago
in
Fairfield.
Old friend from far away.
Yeah, she is from far away now. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Marcy Lukart.
Hi, Monica. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi,
everybody in Fairfield.
Well, I think they're pretty good. Fairfield has is really quite the cultural center now. I hear
people keep telling me I need.
Yeah.
I won't believe it if I went back to visit.
No,
I think it's true. And in fact, I had a conversation a while back with a guy, a Wall Street guy, you know, private equity Wall Street guy, whose son is in L.A. as a musician in LA, and he told me, he goes, you know, I'm pretty sure my son has played in Fairfield. You know, Fairfield's really a hot spot for touring musicians.
Cool.
And I said, yeah, I know.
Well, you know, the Sondheim has, I mean, it doesn't just have now and then things, it has constant.
That's true.
Constant performers.
Yeah. So, Marcy, when are you coming to see us?
I don't know. I think I'm just going to have to come on a book tour.
I think that would be a great idea. And let's introduce Marcy's book.
River Braids. And it's a novel. It's most interesting. The way it's organized is just really interesting.
And I'm going to read the little author bio for those of you who do not know Marcy. Marcy Lukart, who was Marcy Wolfe when she lived here, has been writing her whole life. Her short stories have appeared in The Iconoclast, Bellowing Ark, Pangolin Papers, Beginnings, QWF, and The Connecticut Review. Marcy lives in California with her husband Ralph and a miniature poodle. She enjoys obedience and agility training with the poodle, hiking, camping, fiddling, painting, and most especially a good story. And Marcy and I were in writers' groups together. Took writing classes together, 20 years ago?
I know, a long time ago,
probably more than that.
A lifetime.
From the beginning.
A lifetime ago. So, Marcy, tell us how River Braids came to be.
Well, it was really Ralph, my husband, and his brother had always talked about building a raft and floating down the Mississippi River. And, you know, people talk about things like that, but most people don't do them. But Ralph and his brother flew out to Hannibal, Missouri, and they found the people in Hannibal were incredible. They were just so generous. And they found this one guy who let them build a raft in his driveway. And, you know, everybody was helping them, you know, get resources together. The guy lent him tools. So then the guy had a big flatbed truck, and they put the raft in the river in Quincy, Illinois. And I flew out to join them. So we basically spent two nights just, I mean, you can't do much. You float down the river. We had oars to kind of direct us a little bit, but you're pretty much at the river's mercy. We went through one of the locks, and we just camped on the islands.
Wow.
There are lots of islands in the Mississippi.
Yeah, well, we just spent two nights. Well, actually, the first night, which is kind of how the book ended up happening, we're in the river outside of Quincy, and we're there like maybe 10 minutes, and the oar lock broke. So, we're frantically with one oar trying to get this very unwieldy raft. I mean, this is a big, it's like, I don't know how big it was.
What's it made out of? Logs?
It was made out of plywood.
Okay.
Wood put on top of empty oil drums.
Okay. Oh, okay, yeah.
And we had, we had a railing so that we couldn't roll off very easily.
I was going to say, that sounds a little scary out in the middle of the river.
A little precarious.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there's a lot of pretty intense river traffic. There's big things. But we're kind of hugging the shore as much as we can. And we can go shallow where they can't. But anyway, so the river breaks, and we pull over to the side, and we end up camping on this dock. And there was this really cool building. I mean, it's just a beautiful old rowing club is what it was. I mean, but it had been seen better days because it had been destroyed in one of the floods. Anyway, so I was a short story writer, and I come home, and I'm starting to write a short story just about a couple of brothers doing a trip down the river. A novel was not in my awareness at all. And as I was trying to refresh myself of just, some local color, the visuals. So when I'd been in this club, there had been some incredible pictures on the wall, some old, old rowing teams of, from the turn of the century. So I was just trying to find a picture so that I could have it in front of me while I was describing a scene in the short story. So as I'm finding the pictures, I start reading about the old river days, before there were locks and dams. I mean, the river, it wasn't controlled back then.
So you're looking for pictures on the internet? Is that?
Yeah, well, and books. I was finding books that were available, and then I would buy the books, and have them sent to me with the pictures. And almost all of them were related to the 1904 Louisiana Purchase Exposition, which was also, there was a little Olympics going on there, the World's Fair in St. Louis. So all of a sudden I start reading about the World's Fair and what was going on there, and I got a what if, and so these other characters just started coming. And then that's my dog.
that's the poodle.
The miniature poodle.
Yep.
1904 characters sort of had their story going, and my brothers had their story going, and then they just kind of merged, and we ended up with River Braid.
Now, where are you in this novel?
I'm not really in here, except in terms of, my life experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not really a character, really. Yeah, there's no me in here.
Now, what year was it that you did this Mississippi River trip?
Well, gosh, I should know this because my Ralph and I were trying to talk about this, but I think it's about 6 years now. So I think it was in 2005 or 2006 we were there.
Okay. And did you come to Fairfield then?
No.
That's why I don't remember.
I flew into St. Louis. We went to Hannibal. I kept thinking, I'm only a few hours' drive from Fairfield, but I didn't have that much time. Flew into St. Louis, and it was a couple hours, drive up to Hannibal. Then we kind of went back south, from Quincy back south, and then I just had to catch the plane in St. Louis again, so I never went north.
Now, your husband and his brother are native Californians, correct?
Yeah.
So what attracted them to the Mississippi River? Why was this a dream?
Oh, it's just the Huck Finn fantasy.
Mm.
You know, it's just, you know, the Huck Finn floating down the big Mississippi River. I mean, it's just, it's kind of iconic, I think. You know, and they were wanting to do a little bonding thing, so.
And did the reality live up to their expectation?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's really an incredible. I don't think many people see the river like we saw the river.
Oh, no, no.
Up close and personal.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're just, you know, and I don't think very many people, even when they're there, pull over onto any of these islands, you know.
No, probably not.
These little hidden places, and they change. They're always changing depending on, you know, what's going on with the water. It was really, it was very magical. I mean, it was a lot of just hanging around looking at the sky, but it was magical.
Well, you know, there's...
It took 2 days to go, like, 30 miles.
Oh, wow.
Like, now, not that far from Quincy there.
Did they go further on, or was that...
No, we came out in Hannibal, and we donated the raft to the Boy Scouts.
Oh.
Very good.
Wow.
Well, you know, there's quite a drive to clean up the river. Some guy has been working on it now for several years.
Really?
And they have found unbelievable stuff. I mean, we're talking freezers and, oh, yeah. People dump all kinds of stuff in the river.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and every time there's a big flood, you know. Actually, the funniest was coming through these locks and dams. Because, you know, I mean, they're there. They've got, you know, these big river boats going through, you know. And we kind of come up in this little... We're like right next to the water, waving up at the guy. Well, the whole lock for us, you know, we go down.
They must have thought you were nuts.
I know. They're waving at us. Who are they? But they, you know, it's all there.
You know, the book Huckleberry Finn, who were we talking to that they said, you know, that book was banned in public schools for years and years.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah, because it was not deemed
it
to be.
It was a very controversial book. We had our last guest, actually, who wrote the book about 50 books.
Oh, yeah, 50 books that you should read.
Practical
classics,
yeah. 50 books from high school that you should revisit. He talked about, you know, one of the chapters was Huck Finn. It was controversial for a number of reasons, and one of them was... that Huck was, originally it was because Huck was not considered a very good role model for children.
Ah.
And Louisa May Alcott actually blasted Mark Twain for having written this book and saying, you know, no child should be allowed to read it, which this author thought was rather amusing considering that she had been a writer of soft porn.
Which I find hard to believe, but I guess it's true.
And was always a little upset that Little Women was what made her famous when she really preferred writing erotica.
Basically. Oh, that is funny. That's
I know. Isn't that funny?
I know.
You learn interesting things on this program.
Really, that is fascinating.
So, yeah, and then it became controversial, too, because of the how he handled the racial situation. Some people thinking that he, you know, some, you know, people who were very prejudiced, you know, feeling like he was too sympathetic towards the black people, whereas later on it was like, well, that he didn't portray black people with their own strength or power or something, you know. So there were a lot of reasons that people decided they did not like.
But it was
that.
A good yarn.
But it's a right, and it has stuck. It has
It's been around for a long time.
It's met the test of time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you go back and you start writing this short story that becomes a novel.
Uh-huh.
And now, is this the first novel that you've written?
This is the first completed novel. There are many half completed novels sitting in the computer.
Uh-huh.
First completed novel.
And why do you think that you completed this one? What was it about it that took you forward to completion?
Gosh, that's interesting. I don't know. I never thought about it. I guess the story just felt, I guess I didn't get bored with it.
I was going to say, could it have been that your personal experience on the river and actually being there had something to do with the idea, yes, I'm going to write this and it's going to get done?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, the others, I think this one, the story just was much more clear to me.
Mm.
I mean,
yeah,
I've been taking,
because you were there,
writing classes here. I took a lot of workshops. I've been at the Santa Barbara Writers Conference a lot. And I've been working, and I haven't for a few years, but with somebody here named Shelley Lowenkopf, who was, he's taught at USC, and he's just been teaching writing workshops forever. And just, and you hear him doing critiques, and you hear him talking to people, and what he keeps saying is, where's the story? Where's the story? Where's the story? You know, and then a lot of times, you know, I'll write, and it's like character studies, and it's little vignettes, but there's no story. And for this one, a story emerged for me, different way.
Yeah, you know, this jumped out to me. It was on page 105. It says, the ocean is nothing like the river. The ocean is just big. It doesn't have the same kind of personality. It doesn't make you feel safe. It doesn't feel like the arteries carrying blood. You can predict the ocean. You can predict the tides. You could even predict the hurricanes, but you can't predict this river. At least you couldn't back then. A few good beavers and the river can change. That's great. That's a great line. It really is.
Wow.
Oh, I forgot about that one. Thanks, Carol.
Yeah. So I'm going to remind our listeners that this is Writers' Voices, and I'm Monica Hadley, and my co-host is Caroline Kilborn, and our guest today is Marcy Leuchart, the author of River Braids, a novel. So you finished it. You finished the novel, the first one you completed. Did you start sending it out right away?
Oh, yeah. I tried. Well, I mean, I went through a whole bunch of edits. I mean, I worked with a lot of editors. I worked with a lot of writing groups. I worked with a lot of editors. So, you know, I really got it to a point where, you know, I thought that it was good. And then I tried sending it out to agents, and that was just, like, the worst experience of my life.
Okay, is that,
we've heard that
the
before.
Point where you said you weren't writing anymore?
Yes.
Okay, because when Marcy contacted me and let me know her novel was coming out, I'm like, what? I thought you stopped. You said you weren't writing anymore.
I got so discouraged because, you know, this is the thing. I mean, unless I want to just write a personal diary, I'm writing for people to enjoy the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something to share. It's not an exercise in self-absorption as far as I'm concerned. So to have a novel that people aren't going to read is just so sad.
Yeah.
You know, you have a painting, you can at least put a frame and put it on the wall.
People will see it whether they want to or not.
They want to or not. They want to see it. So, you know, and the whole publishing world now is so hard. You know, I mean, I got, you know, agents, no, sorry, not for us, no, sorry, not for us, no, sorry, not for us. We, you know, great story, I don't think we can sell it, really good, you know. And then I got a rant back from an agent saying, you know, you can't, this kind of book, it's a wonderful book, but, you know, they're not interested in these things anymore. They only want the big blockbusters, the well-known names. You know, and it just got really, it got sad, you know, and so I just thought, forget it. I just put it in a drawer, and I just left it. And then I took it out of the drawer long ago, and I had another friend who said, don't go that route. Just try and find a small press. Small presses will take on, this is what they used to call a mid-list novel.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a thriller. You know, I don't have a big name. And so they said small presses will take these on. You don't go through agents. You just go directly to the press. And I actually found a small local press in Santa Barbara who does not do a lot of fiction, mostly nonfiction, but they had one other novel that had an historical component to it. So his wife, who is their editor read it and said, no, I love this book. Let's take it on. So they took it on.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, we have some really nice small presses in Iowa, too.
There's Ice Cube. Mm-hmm.
Books up in North Liberty. We've done a number of their authors. Wonderful, wonderful books. And also, of course, First World Publishing here in Fairfield.
Of course, I always remember the publisher that took on Chicken Soup for the Soul, when how many publishers turned it down?
Yeah, like 140.
Yeah.
Oh, this will never sell. This will never sell. Yeah, right.
Demoralizing. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Anyway, so I'm glad, because I love, you know, the publisher and his wife, the editor. I mean, we worked really well together. It was a really nice collaboration to get it to this point. And the picture on the book, I don't know if you posted the picture on the website.
I posted your gorgeous picture on the website.
On the back, yes. The picture of the river is one that actually we took while we were in St. Louis.
That's a great picture.
And Greg, the publisher, took it, and I think he just made it into a lovely cover. You really get the sense of the river.
You do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, River Braids, not only the stories weaving themselves together, but the river and its islands weaving itself together.
Oh, you got it.
Yeah, I did.
I hit you over the head with my metaphors. Thank you. Yes, that was the whole point.
Now, as you were writing, and as you go back and read it again, do you know, there are two very, in a sense, separate storylines here. There's the modern day, and then there's 100 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Do you have do you prefer one to the other? Does one draw you in more?
No, you know, it's funny, because I was just, it's like after I put it away for, a year, and then I took it out again, and I started reading it, and I thought, wow, I like this. It's actually not bad. There's something about the atmosphere of the 1904 and the Olympics and the whole experience of the Native American people back in the Olympics at that time. There's an appeal to me there, but then I read the modern day story and the relationship of the brothers and their whole experiences, and then what they're asked to go through that rebonds the modern day characters with their history of the river. I like them both.
Wow. And how was your husband involved in the writing process at all?
He was like a really tense editor for me. Really good. He's so, it's like he doesn't just say, yes, dear, that's lovely.
No, I actually, knowing Ralph, I don't see him doing that.
No. And I said, come on, can't you just say you like it even if you don't? You know? But no, he really made me get clear. You know, if things felt illogical, if time frames weren't working, if he just really made me not be lazy. So that was, I appreciate it. Now I appreciate it. Then.
Then it was just annoying.
Then it was tense.
Yeah.
No, he was like my first really intense editor.
Wow.
And then I took it to Shelley, the guy who's always looking for the story, and he was my second editor.
And did he find the story in it, or did he want you to add more?
No, I had created, no. As I write it, the voice in my head is always asking where's the
story. Okay. So he was there from the beginning.
He was there mostly for my short stories. So I got the story strength when I was writing the short stories.
Now, did you have a completed short story version of this?
No.
Okay.
But I think if you read it, you can kind of tell that as I write it, it's like each thing almost is a short story.
Right.
Has that kind of flow. And I think that's just my natural rhythm.
Yeah. One thing, when I started reading it, I'm pretty sure that I have a postcard from the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, do they have World's Fair anymore? They don't have them anymore, do they?
I don't know.
I don't know when the last one was. That's interesting. I mean, they started having those big, you know, expos, but I don't think they have them in the same way that they used to.
No,
that's
I don't
a very
think so.
Good question. I did not realize that the Olympics was combined with the World's Fair.
No, I didn't either.
Huh, well, at that time, yeah. I mean, it was sort of like a side. It was an afterthought.
But it was the real Olympics.
It was, yeah. It was a real Olympics was held there. And it was not the main, you know, the World's Fair was the main event. And I think they had thought they were going to do it in a different town. And then somebody said, well, let's just do it here at the same time. So,
well, how did you learn what really was going on there? Was it just from
a lot of
books
out there?
Yeah, there are a lot of books.
There's a lot of books about the St. Louis World's Fair and the Louisiana Purchase Exposition. So I kind of bought every book that was written on the subject. And then I would do, research. Then I would just find other things that were kind of written around the era, you know, just to get a sense of what was going on for, you know, in the time.
And, you know, part
of it, it was really incredible when you read about it. The things that were introduced there, the technology and the forward thinking of what was going on, as well as some of the backward social thinking that was going on.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting juxtaposition of what was going on in the world.
Well, you know, people don't realize, I guess, this is not United States Fair. This is a World's Fair.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is from all over the world. People came
yeah.
to show
and,
their
and,
things.
And people did come from all, travel wasn't that easy then, but
yeah.
people were coming from all over.
So one of your characters is an African
yes.
athlete.
Yeah.
And were people like him really there?
Yeah. I think when I read, there were South African athletes, and there was a whole, they had this, they had exhibits, and so South Africa brought a Boer War exhibit. So they brought all kinds of, they brought people that were creating, like, Boer War reenactments.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting.
Now,
and then some of the people who were there also then competed in the Olympics.
Now, part of the historical aspect of this novel goes back even further than 1904 into the 1880s.
Right.
How did you learn about what would have been realistic for that time period?
Well, let's just say that some of that's probably imagination.
Oh, well, yeah.
Well,
had to have some of that.
Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, somebody was asking me, a lot about, the Native American cultural stuff and things like that. And I did talk to, Native Americans and people involved with ceremonies and, tried to get some accuracy. But in reality, I think the story is ultimately more about people. Mm. And so the 1880 thing, it was really more the history of Joe, the main 1904 character, just his father, and just and that was more people oriented.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do a lot of research for that per se.
Okay. And did you ever feel like you needed to come back to the Mississippi as you were writing? To
no. It was that whole experience of, like, floating down it for so many days. And, and the reality is, I mean, I grew up in Chicago, but I've lived sort of near that whole Midwest area. I mean, driving back and forth from Fairfield to Chicago over so many years, you go over the Mississippi a lot and spend a lot of time. I'd stop there and I'd look at it. I hadn't actually lived on the river, but I felt...
You felt a connection to it.
I felt a connection.
Yeah, because...
Yeah, I went to the University of Minnesota, which is kind of way up at the beginning of the river, but,
You absorbed it. You absorbed it.
I walk over that river
yeah.
every day for many years.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, a friend of mine, another former guest on our show, Cheryl B. Anderson, who's a professor at Garrett Seminary in Chicago, wrote an essay about crossing the Mississippi, because she drives back and forth from Chicago to Fairfield frequently too. And at some point she had this feeling as she was crossing the Mississippi, thinking back to slave times and what crossing the Mississippi might have meant at that time.
Right, right. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a fluid, ever-changing, you know, artery. I mean, it really is.
Well, when it floods, some of those islands, of course, get...
Yeah, I mean, just driving, watch. I mean, when we were doing that trip, you would just see the huge, big barges. I mean, these barges are incredible, that carry everything. And you would just see, often a field, way off, just a barge, and the only way it could have gotten there was when the river flooded and just abandoned it there.
Mm-hmm.
Fish getting left at high tide.
Wow. Oh my!
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that's something.
It's neat to fly over the Mississippi because you see then all the islands and the braids.
Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Marcy Leuchart, the author of River Braids, a novel. Marcy, why don't you read something from River Braids for us?
Okay. So this is kind of at the beginning of the book, and I'm not giving much away here. The book is told from three characters. We have Joe in 1904, and then we have diary entries of Annie in 1904. And then in current day, we have Sonny, who is Joe's grandson. And basically, in 1904, Joe is going to the Olympics because he is part of a team that's going to compete in a rowing race. And when he gets there, he receives a letter saying that he can't participate because they've recently discovered that he's part Native American Indian, and Native Americans can't participate in the Olympics. And that is historically true.
And what was the rationale?
That they're not Americans, I guess.
Oh. Oh. Okay.
Okay.
They weren't American citizens, so they couldn't participate. But then they had another set of games that they called the anthropology games. And this is also historically accurate, that this was where they took indigenous peoples who were at the fair setting up realistic villages, and they competed in what were deemed appropriate activities for native peoples. They had spear throwing and rope pulling and things like that. And so they also had a Wild West show. And so Joe is going to work at the Wild West show. And this is his first, he's going to check in. A group of soldiers in gray uniforms stood at attention in front of Mulhall. "You are a bunch of pansy-ass soldiers. I want to feel your rage and anger. I want you to hate and massacre. I don't want any of this namby-pamby horseback riding. I want a charge, a hell-bent charge. People are paying good money to see a show, and if we aren't careful, they'll get Wild Bill in here faster than you can say Little Bighorn." Mulhall had a thick Irish accent that made the curses sound like a song. I stood off to one side. He saw me out of the corner of his eye. "What the hell do you want?" "I was told to see you. I guess I'm the replacement." I told them I needed an engine, a real engine. I pride myself on giving them the real thing. "I am the real thing." "No, you ain't. You got red hair." "My mother was Indian." Mulhall put his face up close to mine. The odor of tobacco and whiskey on his breath was so strong I could almost taste it. "No way. I can smell it. And you don't smell like engine. You smell like something else. I don't know what it is, but you sure don't smell like engine. These clowns." He waved his hand around the field. "Now they smell like engine." So that was how it was going to be. I couldn't row with the guys because I wasn't American enough, and I couldn't ride with the Indians because I didn't smell enough. Hey, Zach, someone called from nowhere. We got to do this. The troops are getting restless. Okay, you, what the hell's your name? He didn't wait for me to answer. Pinky. He laughed when he said it. Pinky, get suited up. Go over there with the Apache. And when you see someone shoot, you drop. That's your cue. Clutch your chest and fall to the ground. And I don't want to see you move as much as a toenail again until you hear me tell you. He walked over to the side of the field and picked up a megaphone, like the one Greer used when he was calling our strokes. I ran off to the changing room behind an old Indian blanket attached to a clothesline. I put on stiff buckskins, leather chaps, and moccasins. Places, Mulholl called through a megaphone. As I ran out from behind the blanket, someone stuck a black wig with a long braid onto my head. Here, put this on. We can't have no redheads running with the Apaches, boys. I headed out to the field, pulling the wig down tight as I ran. I took my place next to one of the Apaches. His costume was tattered and dirty. Probably another body, I thought. I was glad I didn't have to fall off a horse. Where do we go? The tattered man stared at my clean outfit. You'll figure it out. Oh. And then there was chaos. We Apaches were yelling, trilling, and whooping while waving decorated spears and small axes. I hadn't expected all the sounds, the explosions of rifles going off and pistols shooting. I heard names called out, Big Feather, Little Foot, and with each name someone dropped right where they were in the middle of the mayhem. I didn't want to drop. I didn't want to fall. I didn't want to be trampled by the horses that came up from behind. So I ran faster and farther. My side ached. Yell, wave your arms, pretend you're attacking, someone shouted beside me. I am yelling, I shouted back. My whole head was yelling. I nearly ran into a horse coming straight at me. There was a rifle pointed at my chest, and a puff of smoke came out of the opening. I felt a pain in my chest, a piercing pain. I clutched my chest. I was sure I'd been shot, that the rifle pointing right at me had just shot me. I was dead. I was going to die right here on this stupid, dusty field in this ridiculous costume, and I couldn't even smell the river. I clutched my chest where I thought I'd been hit, my heart pounding so hard I felt it in my ears, heard it in my throat. I fell to my knees first, then my head dropped back. I was panting. I could hardly breathe anymore, and then I fell forward, my face in the dirt. The mayhem passed me by. It got quiet. I wasn't dead. A muffled voice next to me whispered, Nice drop, Pinky. Are you a real actor?
Oh, that's good. That was good.
I couldn't answer. I lay there, the dust thick on my tongue. All I could think was that from now on, I needed to drop with my head sideways, my mouth shut.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, gosh.
So, Marcy, as you were writing the sections of the book, and most of the chapters are fairly short. Some of the diary entries are only a page or two.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you're going back and forth between time and even in the same time between characters. I'm wondering how you decided what order these different chapters would go in.
Well, what I was trying to do was a lot of the Annie, the diary entries, for me are, it's a little bit more exposition, a little bit more history of what's going on at the time. So as Sonny in current day was finding out things about his family and his grandfather, I was kind of braiding what was going on back at the time with it so that the reader would be in modern day, but it would relate a little bit more tangibly. You know, there would be a parallel to what was going on with his grandfather.
Mm.
And historically.
Did you ever, like, lay everything out and sort of move things around?
Oh, yeah. I had color-coded cards.
And when you wrote it, I'm assuming you didn't write it in the same order that it ended up in.
No. I kind of wrote, I sort of wrote almost, well, I think I pretty much wrote each character by themselves, you know, to a certain extent. It's like each character's story. But it just didn't feel right to have, like, one character as a lump and then another character and then another character. And it was actually when I had the chapters and the cards and I was trying to figure out, okay, how do I organize this so that the organization helps tell the story? I think that's, Carolyn, when the braiding came to me. I realized that I was actually braiding this story together.
Yeah.
And when you came up with this title, River Braids, was it like immediately, yes, that's the title?
Yeah. It just was like that. It sat in my computer, you know, for the longest time with, Sun. First there was Sunny. You know, there was like a whole, kind of a whole novel of Sunny. Then there was Joe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, right.
And it was Sunny and Joe, and they were all their own separate things, but it didn't feel right. It just didn't feel coherent.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have seen books where you have like three sort of interrelated stories, but they're segregated, you know, so one's
right.
not one, the first third is one of the stories, the second third is another mm-hmm. one, and mm-hmm. So, you know, that is an option. People have done that. But I kind of like it this way where you
weave it together.
Where you weave it together.
Yeah, it just kind of felt like it needed that.
Yeah.
It just felt disjointed without that to me. So.
Okay, who was the main Indian character? Was that Red Feather? Was that him?
That was Red Feather.
Yeah. He had I have a quote here that he did, and the reason I like it so much is because it reminds me of Monica's dad. He says, "Everyone walks a path, two paths in our lives, one our feet walk and the other that our heart walks. Some men spend their whole lives looking for their paths, looking for home." Right? Your dad, right?
Yeah, that's true. So I'm interested in how the African character came into being.
Gosh, you know, I have to say, to be quite honest, I can't always remember how these characters came into being. It started a while ago. I think a lot of it came when I was reading about, I think that one came, that was sort of an image that I had it was when I wrote an early Sunny chapter, and I kind of saw Sunny just looking at the river and that there was like Sunny was remembering an experience when his grandfather took him to meet a very old black man, and so that was a visual that I had, and then all of a sudden I realized, oh, that black man was with Joe. And then where did he come from? And I think that came from when I saw pictures of the runners during the Olympics. I mean, a lot of, you know, it's like I'll get an image, and then I just kind of just start following it. It's not like I start out and say, oh, he's going to have a friend who came from South Africa. It's more like he's there, and I'm trailing behind Joe as he's meeting people and finding them. And then I'm discovering the people as Joe finds them.
Well, you had an enormous amount of research and different, and all these books and pictures and everything. It must have been hard sometimes to sort everything out.
Yeah, well, I think that's why it comes from character, to be quite honest. It's like I have my characters, and then I just try and see them in where they are, and that's why I needed all the books and the pictures so I could really see them where they were.
Right.
And then once I can see them where they are, then they're just living their lives and meeting each other, and then the new characters emerge. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah,
it does. Now, as you got
so not outlined. This was not outlined.
You got so involved in that world, the 1904 St. Louis Exposition world. Was it when you were finished? Was it hard to leave that behind? Did you miss it?
No, I have to say that by the time I finished, I was like sick of it.
You know, I can see that. Yeah.
So much time, you know, writing. It's like after a while, it's like, oh gosh, it was a year later after I put it away and took it out again that I started liking everybody again.
I mean, you probably didn't really set out to write a historical novel.
No, I did not set out to write
it. Would you do it again?
I still don't even think that it's an historical novel. You know, it's funny, in my mind, it's a novel about people, and oh, that it just happens to be in that year.
So there's no sequel in the offing?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't see how I could.
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
They're gone.
So is there?
Although my one friend said, she said, I really want, you know, she said, I don't think you're done. She said, I think you could do more with Annie.
I was just thinking that.
Yeah.
And you were going to read a piece of Annie for us, weren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it's just short, a little okay. Annie, because you had said, you know, the fair.
Right.
So I've got Annie when she, so she and her father are taking a riverboat from, they live up in my fictional town of Quinley, and they're on their way down to St. Louis. So July 20th evening, and Annie, it's all diary entries. So, dear diary, we're here. St. Louis is a city of lights. Everywhere I look, there's lights, on the land, on the boats, reflecting off the water. It's a wonder anyone can ever sleep here with so much going on. People coming and going even after dark, but it sure does make you feel welcome. Come in, the lights are always on, is what it seems to say. When I was getting on the train, I stood right behind a dark man wearing a turban that was wound so high it made him tower over everyone. I wonder if that's how tall his head really is. And a snake charmer. Daddy told me not to stare, but I don't see how I can't. I didn't know this many people lived in the world. Even the train was perfect. There wasn't a scratch on any of the wood, and the seats were perfectly cushioned in brand new leather. The brass fittings were so shiny, I wondered how long it took them to get polished like that. Someone must truly love that train to take such good care of it. The most impressive part was the ride itself. It was so smooth, I hardly felt that we were moving. But all that was nothing compared to when we finally arrived at the fairgrounds. I never thought it could be possible, but there were even more lights than in St. Louis. I wish it were already daylight so I could go exploring. I don't think I'll be able to sleep tonight. Our hotel is called the Insight Inn because it's right in the middle of the fairgrounds, and it's a very grand and fancy hotel. I think we were lucky to get in. It's only because Father is an important person that he managed it. John met us at the hotel, but Joe wasn't with him. I know I shouldn't be disappointed, but I was hoping to see Joe so I could smile at him and let him know that everything is okay. John said that Joe's staying someplace else. Someplace else seems like a funny place to be. I think that even if I had to go home right now and never got to see the fair, it wouldn't matter. Today has been the most perfect day.
Mm-hmm. That was Marcy Leuchart reading from River Braids, a novel, which was released on May 1st, I believe.
Yes.
So it's a brand new novel.
Brand new.
Yes. And it's available.
It's at Amazon. You can go to Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble. And if you go to your local bookstore, it's available to all the distributors, so the bookstores can order it,
and you can have it
locally.
And we like to support our local bookstores. Yeah. And you should get some here, put in Revelations here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we really should do that.
Yeah, just have them, you know, they just order them through the regular book rep.
All right.
So what are you?
I can send some on consignment, but it would probably be easier just to get them from the book reps.
Yeah, that's true.
So what are you going to be doing? What are you going to be writing next?
I don't know. It's funny because you get it out there, and so you think, oh, I got it published. Oh, it's out there. And then you think, well, no, now I have to...
Promote it.
So this is my I had a book signing here in town, which was really fun. A whole bunch of local friends came.
Oh.
And then this is like my first national. I'm very excited.
Oh.
My national interview here.
Absolutely.
And then I have to just get my head around what's next. It's like I have to get the whole, marketing thing. But I am trying to get a Facebook page up. It's River Dash Braids. I can get you a link to it, and people can go and like it. And if people read it, just read it and enjoy it and put reviews up.
Right.
That's a really big thing for unknown authors, is getting reviews.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's like my publisher said, it's reviews are gold.
Mm.
And I'm telling people I'd love to talk to your book clubs too, if people know book clubs.
You were in a book club here in Fairfield years ago that I think is still going on.
I need to get everybody's emails again and have them read
yes,
the book.
Yes, absolutely.
I'll talk to you by Skype. If you're in California, I'll drive there. If anybody has ideas, just anybody who's listening, I hope you enjoy the book, buy the book, and then get in touch with me. I have a website. It's marcyluckhart.com.
And that's spelled MarcyLuckhart. Right.
I can get you all those links, Monica, and if you want to put them on.
I'll do that. I'll do that.
Link to me.
So, yeah, it's interesting because nowadays you can't just be a writer. You have to be a writer and a marketer, too.
Yeah. With a publisher behind you, the publisher
Absolutely.
Only does so much.
Right.
He's got it in his catalog. He's got his book reps out there, showing it to bookstores. But it's the nature of the publishing industry now that there's limited shelf space. And
Right. And so many books being published.
So many books being published. And how do bookstores choose? Well, they choose by authors that they know are going to sell. So it becomes this, I guess it's kind of similar to what the music industry has gone through.
Yeah, and it's ever changing. But it also gives you an opportunity to connect directly with your readers. And,
Absolutely.
The social media,
Absolutely.
You can do a
lot
with that.
Somebody gives me a good review, I can send them a private message and say thank you. And
yeah.
So, and there have been some nice reviews. We sent out some pre-release copies to people on Goodreads, and so some people there have been reading it. And,
yeah, tell us a little bit more about Goodreads. We haven't really discussed that on Writer's Voices
before.
Well,
Goodreads, as far as I can tell, is kind of like a Facebook for readers.
Mm.
Basically, you sign up, and then you connect with friends, and you have your friends, and people can rate books and leave comments about books. And they can refer it to their friend circle, but it's only books. It's nothing else. I read this book. I liked it, and it's not just new books. I went on, and somebody I know was rereading The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. So just all books, people rate them, and it's kind of like, like Netflix and Amazon.
Right.
They get a sense of what you like, and then they start recommending other books for you based on your likes
and dislikes. Oh, it does that? Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, and I think I just heard actually Amazon just bought Goodreads.
Oh, figures.
So it's actually going to be part of Goodreads, part of Amazon, but probably still separate. But it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's a good way to find books.
Now,
people are in your circles, they say, oh, I read a good book. Here it is.
Is River Braids going to be available as an ebook?
It will be available as an ebook, but probably not for a few months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Actually, I'm having people ask if it's going to be an audiobook too, but
oh, yeah.
Hopefully, but probably not right away.
That would be very cool.
Yeah.
I know, because I do listen to my e-books when I'm driving.
Right.
My Audible books.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left. Do you have any final words of wisdom for your former Fairfield writing friends?
Well, thank you for listening, if you're listening.
Oh.
And thank you, Monica and Carolyn.
Oh.
Well, it was a pleasure.
This was way more fun than I remembered.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
It was a pleasure.
And
it was
then
a pleasure.
I would say just always be asking yourself, where's the story?
Mm. Yeah, there you go. Where's the story?
Yeah.
Everybody has a story.
Yeah. You know, and it's out there. And I think often as writers, we lose that people are reading for a story. They're not reading for
the beautiful way that you have of expressing yourself.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
They might like that for
they
a
like
little
that
bit,
too.
But ultimately
right.
It's the story that
mm-hmm.
takes them to where they want to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Well, that was Marcy Lucart with River Braids, a novel. And thank you for joining us on Writers' Voices. And Marcy, I hope I see you and talk to you soon.
Yes, we will do a book tour.
Yes.
And I have my RV be able to make it from here to there without breaking down.
Sounds like a good plan.
That was easy, wasn't it, Marcy? Wasn't that easy?
That was fun.
Yeah, I knew it would be.
So,
yeah.
Caroline, do you have some parting quote for us today?
This is from Ben Franklin. Remember not only to say the right thing at the right place, but to leave unsaid the wrong thing at the tempting moment.
See you next week on Writer's Voice.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.